DW Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On today's programme, Macron's concessions to France's yellow vest protesters. Britain's Brexit chaos.
It's become so serious and constitutionally challenging that the only way to deal with it seems to be to take it as a bit of light entertainment. Indeed, it's become a meme among journalist colleagues to post popcorn emojis on social media ahead of every negotiation, renegotiation and cabinet reshuffle. We're ready for the show. Bring it on.
Exactly. Also on the show, human rights groups slam Italy's latest crackdown on migrants and the Austro-Hungarian tradition of ballroom dancing alive and well in the Czech Republic. These stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. After a month of increasingly violent and increasingly popular protest in France, President Emmanuel Macron made on Monday what many commentators described as a last-ditch attempt to appease the yellow vest protesters. In a 13-minute address from the Élysée Palace, the French president offered a kind of a mea culpa, compassion for the many millions in France who are struggling to make ends meet, and he offered a series of measures to relieve their hardship. In Paris, John Laurenson reports.
Française, Français.
The start of what was doubtless the most important speech of Emmanuel Macron's presidency so far, one upon which depended his survival as president. The government's handling of a protest sparked by new fuel taxes supposed to impact global warming started by calling the protesters Nazis. The Prime Minister said they would never surrender. The first presidential address, offering to create a committee to look into different ways of tackling climate change, hardened the yellow vest resolve. After another day of violence in Paris, the government said it was delaying the new fuel tax. Then, a day later, it said it was scrapping it for this year. But it was too late. The protests had gathered too much steam. It wasn't going to be stopped so easily. So, on Monday, the president offered this.
Le salaire d'un travailleur au SMIC augmentera de 100 euros par mois dès 2019.
The salary of a worker on the minimum wage will rise by 100 euros a month from the start of 2019, without this costing employers a single euro. Overtime will be exempted from tax and social security contributions from the beginning of 2019. And so people can feel an immediate improvement in their lot, I ask all employers who are able to do so to pay their employees a New Year's bonus, which will also be exempt from tax and social security contributions. For retired people living on less than 2,000 euros a month, we hereby cancel the rise in social security contributions scheduled for next year.
Is it enough? Many yellow vests went on the French media to say no, it wasn't.
He put on the kid gloves this time. I think he'd been properly briefed this time so that he'd behave more respectfully, which he hasn't done up till now. He apologized, but I think it's more smoke and mirrors than anything else. He's now really frightened that France will rise up and he'll lose his place at the top.
Opinion polls have shown a 12-point decrease in support for the Gilets Jaunes since this last presidential address. But 53% of French people still support them, even though they do not have anything like a clear programme, their demands ranging from reintroduction of the wealth tax abolished by Macron and opposition to the UN Migrants' Rights Charter that France just signed. Jean-Michel Apathy is one of France's leading radio and TV political commentators. What Macron announced will cost the already deep in debt French state 10 billion euros. It is, he says, a comprehensive victory with which they should be happy to settle.
The yellow vests have given us a political upheaval. They have changed the nature of political debate and the political balance of power in the country. The yellow vests have broken Emmanuel Macron. They have broken his momentum, his career, and his youth. On Monday night, he was no longer 40 years old. He'd aged 10 years. But now that they have won, is it legitimate for them to keep blocking roads, stopping business from operating, and calling for demonstrations every Saturday?
Nous sommes à un moment historique.
pour notre pays.
We are, said Macron, at an historic moment. Through dialogue, respect and commitment, we shall succeed, he said. And indeed, if this extraordinary range of concessions, more than any trade union movement has won for decades, does not put an end to the Yellow Vest movement, it is difficult to imagine what will. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Britain, deal, no deal. Second referendum, no Brexit. It's been chaos. And it's reached fever pitch during the week as Prime Minister Theresa May backed away from putting her Brexit deal in front of Parliament. She then survived a no-confidence vote from her own party. Lars Bevanger has been following the Brexit circus as somewhat of an outsider. He's Norwegian. He's been following it since the vote in 2016 and sent this postcard from the northern English city of Manchester.
These days, my wife keeps asking me, what do you think will happen? What's going to happen next? Granted, I am a news junkie who's had Brexit debates from the House of Commons on a constant feed for months now. Oh, wait, it's years, isn't it? But I have absolutely no clue as to what's going to happen next. It doesn't worry me too much, though, because neither have MPs, or, it would seem, the PM. Pressed on that same question by the BBC, what's going to happen next, a senior Conservative MP said he believed in sanity. For a moment, I was sure he was going to say he believed in Santa. To me, it would have made much more sense, because right now, it really looks like anything could happen, and that anything could be true. Or lies. Of course, that's exactly what the two sides in the debate have been accusing each other of telling since the referendum was called way back in the normal days of 2016, before Donald Trump was president. The Brexiteers said the Remainers were simply rolling out Project Fear, telling people that leaving the EU would be disastrous and create complete chaos. A different kind of chaos from what we're seeing now, I suppose, since the country hasn't actually left yet. Meanwhile, the Remainers pretty much accused the Brexiteers of wanting to reclaim the colonies and reinstate Queen Victoria. What we are left with is a country more divided than ever. The only thing more and more people seem to be able to agree on, however, is that nobody voted for this. Nobody voted to see a parliament in a seemingly unbreakable deadlock with a government made up of a party about to implode or explode, I don't know which, while civil servants frantically prepare for a no-deal scenario where we are told we might run out of food and medicines within days of the 29th of March next year. It's become so serious and constitutionally challenging that the only way to deal with it seems to be to take it as a bit of light entertainment. Indeed, it's become a meme among journalist colleagues to post popcorn emojis on social media ahead of every negotiation, renegotiation and cabinet reshuffle. We're ready for the show. Bring it on. And what about David Cameron? Remember him?
I expect to go to the palace and offer my resignation, so we'll have a new Prime Minister in that building behind me by Wednesday evening. Thank you very much. Right.
Yes, him, who decided to call the Brexit referendum in the first place and promptly resigned in a seemingly jolly mood when he lost. He was supposed to release his autobiography this autumn. It's been delayed until sometime next year. I wonder why. Whatever happens, a deal, no deal, new referendum, elections or no Brexit, it does seem inevitable that this great nation will come out of this sorry saga more divided than ever. The only light I can see in the tunnel right now, and believe me, it's a long tunnel, is that in 20 years' time, most of the old leave and remain diehards will have retired from public life and a new generation will have taken over. And that generation was pretty much in agreement at the time of the referendum. More than 70% of under-24-year-olds voted Remain. We'll just have to wait and see what they make of the mess left behind for them by the current, dare I say it, leaders. Lars Bevanger, DW, Manchester.
You're listening to Inside Europe. Italy's coalition government has come under mounting criticism from human rights groups, including Amnesty International, for what they say is the erosion of protections for asylum seekers, as well as a rise in xenophobic rhetoric in Italy. They are particularly concerned about a new law dubbed the Salvini Decree, championed by the country's populist interior minister, Matteo Salvini. The law abolishes humanitarian protection for those not eligible for refugee status and who cannot be sent home. Megan Williams has more from Rome.
Italy's interior minister Matteo Salvini at a recent far-right rally here in Rome, telling the crowd his refusal to allow migrant rescue ships to dock at Italian ports has led to a fall in the number of deaths at sea. It's true the total number of drowning deaths of migrants in the Mediterranean is down this year, with more than 2,000 people dying. But with fewer and fewer humanitarian rescuers at sea as a result of a campaign against them, the number of deaths per migrant attempting the crossing has tripled. And with the new Salvini decree now in effect in Italy, those who survive the crossing are facing tougher times here too.
Questo evento quindi noi l'abbiamo costruito non per rispondere a Salvini che sta a piazza dove sta? Chi? Piazza.
Giovanna Cavallo addresses a small crowd of homeless migrants and Italians trying to help them out behind Rome's Tiburtina train station. She's urging people to sign a change.org petition to get a permanent structure for Rome's homeless migrants here at the station. The group is clustered beside a small Christmas tree set up in a bleak stretch of concrete where some 50 young African migrants sleep each night.
We give them blankets at night and we keep on giving hot breakfast and dinner.
Cavallo and Andrea Costa are part of the Baobab volunteer group that has provided help to the thousands of migrants who have passed through Rome and to the young men who now call this chilly expanse of sidewalk home. Costa says the Salvini decree has been harmful to the migrants in Italy because it equates migrants with criminals.
Migration is strictly connected with security. While we think it's a wrong approach to the issue, also it abolishes humanitarian protection.
Italy is the only EU country that offers humanitarian permits, special protection for people who don't qualify as refugees, but for whom it's too dangerous to go back home. With the repeal of the protection, dozens of people here legally will suddenly find themselves operating even further on the margins of society, says Costa.
It means that from now on, we will have 20,000 more irregular migrants in our country. These are the ones that now have humanitarian protection. They lost it. It will not be renewed.
Most of the migrants who arrive in Italy are granted the permits, which are valid for 2 years and give holders the right to work. Italy's National Statistics Office estimates that by 2020, 130,000 migrants will be illegal in Italy.
Instead of bringing security, it brings insecurity. I mean, we will have more irregular person on the street.
Andrea Costa worries the decree will really mean that thousands of migrants about to lose their permits will slip into petty crime to survive. And he says that the slow, tenuous process of social integration in a country still ill-equipped for immigrants will unravel completely. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
Still to come, we look at Hungary's controversial new labour law, and the tradition of ballroom dancing is alive and well in the Czech Republic. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Hungary's parliament during the week approved changes to the country's labour laws, changes that trade unions and opponents have criticised as a slave law benefiting employers. DW's Hungary correspondent Stefan Boss is with me. Hello, Stefan.
Hello.
Can you tell me what's in this new legislation?
Yes, in this legislation is basically written that from now on, employers can demand from employees that they work up to 400 hours overtime annually from the current 250 hours. And that is, of course, because they simply cannot fill the positions within the companies that are here.
You said that employers can demand. So is this something that's compulsory? You must work the overtime?
Well, it is my understanding that the pressure is definitely possible to put on the employees. But what is also very controversial, that even if they do this overtime, they do not get paid at the end of the year, but only every third year.
Seriously?
Yes, every third year you can get paid for overtime. So it's a very controversial law. And that is also why they call this a slave law. They say that the autocratic Prime Minister Viktor Orban is now demanding us to work really as slaves to fulfill his contracts with multinational companies. And of course it is true, there are several German car makers here, and of course they have told the government that listen, we are okay with having our factories here, but if we cannot find the people, then what are we supposed to do?
Sorry to interrupt you, Stefan. What's the reason that they can't find the people? Is there a labor shortage in Hungary?
Yes, there is a huge labor shortage, and one of the reasons is that at least some 600,000 people have left Hungary in recent years. And of course, another issue is that the Prime Minister has a very strict anti-immigration policy, so he is not welcoming migrants, and that is also one of the reasons why there are simply not enough workers here anymore.
Yeah, but also there's a huge, unemployment in other EU member states is pretty high. For example, Spain, there's a huge youth unemployment. Why aren't the Spanish workers coming into Hungary?
That's a good point. Well, of course, the salaries are still lower here. But also, I have to say that when you speak with foreigners, they not always feel welcomed here. And I know also from people who are, for instance, having a darker skin and so on, they feel really very much discriminated here. I've also witnessed it myself. So the atmosphere starts to change. Of course, it's not everywhere in Hungary, but definitely, I think this is a part of the problem as well.
So that's through now. That's a done deal, is it? Or is there a next stage?
Well, the next stage would be if the president will veto this legislation. That is what the critics are hoping for, but I don't give that a big chance. The president is a very close ally of Prime Minister Viktor Orban, so I don't think he will veto this. And by the way, it will be also more difficult to fight for your rights now, because besides this labor law, a very controversial court reform law was accepted, which basically means, in a nutshell, that the government can appoint judges now who are, for instance, in charge of dealing with cases of corruption and police abuse. And that is also what the critics are saying, and also what human rights groups are saying, that this is really not the way to go.
Stefan Boss, thank you very much for your expertise on that, and we'll watch that with interest on Inside Europe.
You're welcome.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
As well as bringing you the big political stories from Europe every week, we also like a sprinkling of culture. And one of the most enduring traditions from the Austro-Hungarian Empire is still alive in the Czech Republic, ballroom dancing. Czechs still value the ability to glide your way across a parquet floor to a foxtrot, a quick step or waltz. Dance classes are surprisingly popular amongst the young. Almost everyone in high school goes to them, so they don't make a fool of themselves at the graduation ball. Rob Cameron has been watching young Czechs work on their cha-chas and has this from Prague.
Dance teacher Sharka Hesova counts in a quick step, and a crowd of some 150 teenagers attempt to follow her as she guides them with the aid of a microphone and jazz standard The Way You Look Tonight. I'm here at the Prague Congress Centre, a huge, hulking 1970s building, which each Friday night lends one of its many parquet-floored rooms to the Hesse Dance Academy, one of perhaps two dozen in the Czech capital, catering for people of all ages who just want to let their hair down and dance. Although these secondary school students want to learn how to dance, just like their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and endless generations before them did. Daniel Narovec is a 15-year-old IT student.
Well, for me, it's that I want to dance, not professionally, but in matter of social community. There's a need for that when you are older. You may go to some places that it's needed because it's quite normal in Czech Republic by now.
There's a particularly cruel moment at the beginning of each dance when 80 boys on one side of the room rush towards 78 girls standing at the other. Organisers can never guarantee an exact 50-50 gender split in terms of who shows up to lessons, so inevitably there are a couple of girls left standing awkwardly on the sidelines as the others dance. I watched that happen to 17-year-old Daniela Tsarskova, and afterwards I asked her whether such potential for embarrassment in front of her teenage peers didn't make dance class a bit of a nightmare.
No, I quite enjoy it. I'm here alone, but most of the people here are here with their partners, and it's fun. Yeah. We're just starting, so we learn some classic dances, and after that, we'll probably learn some modern dances.
And lo and behold, a few moments later, Daniela was being led around the room, not ably, but competently enough, by Josef Jirolt, 16.
My daddy told me once day, hey, you are going to dance classes, so I have to go.
So it wasn't your choice?
No, it wasn't.
Do you enjoy it? Do you like it?
Yeah, first time I was scared, but now I think it's fine. Yeah, I have my cousin here, so it's fine.
Šárka Hesová, the head of the Hesse Dance Academy, says over the last 15 years, she's taught the foxtrot, quickstep and cha-cha to literally thousands of teenagers and adults, often deliberately using modern music to teach dances that are 100, 200 or even, like the waltz, almost 300 years old. Dancing, she says, is simply in people's blood, especially here in Central Europe.
I think people here go to dance classes because it's a tradition. It's a huge tradition here in the Czech Republic, and it's still very much alive, which is great. Young people here are still dancing, still going to dance classes, and most expect to go. It's part of their secondary school education, really. There are lots of balls here, graduation balls and so on. So it's a really unique tradition. And in terms of the number of people who go, perhaps unique in the world.
Šárka Hesová says the runaway popularity of TV shows such as Stardance has certainly boosted interest in her dancing lessons, though it sounds like it didn't need much boosting in the first place. Certainly, learning to dance because it's a vital social skill was not the only reason given at the Congress Center. Most of them admitted that one of the main reasons they were there was contact, with some dancers even intimate contact with members of the opposite sex. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
If you'd like to contact the show, we would love to hear from you. Here's our email address, europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the next half an hour, we have a very interesting special report from the German city of Dresden.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
It's every parent's worst nightmare, the loss of a child. But just how great must the anguish be if you can't even grieve properly because you're not allowed to see the body, and where probing too much could put you in the crosshairs of your country's secret police. When Yvonne Ranisch was growing up in Dresden, in what was then East Germany, she knew from her parents that she had an older brother called Christoph and that he had died in a clinic when he was an infant. What she did not know was that her mother harboured suspicions that he was still alive, possibly snatched by the communist state and given to a family that was more aligned with the regime. It was only after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when her mother was able to investigate what happened to Christoph, that she started to hear strange accounts from other bereaved parents, whose stories weren't so different from her own. Now the family is hoping to clear up decades of uncertainty by exhuming Christoph's grave. Natalie Müller went to Dresden to meet the family.
And they said he passed away last night. What a shock. No explanation. They wanted to see the body. No, he's already gone, can't see him. And that was it. And then they have never seen him again. There's a white coffin, because for children you used white coffin, and that was in June 75.
Faint light is starting to filter through the trees at the Trinity Cemetery in Dresden. It's just after 7 in the morning, and two undertakers are at work, knee-deep in a grave, plunging their shovels into the soil. Yvonne Ranisch is here with her parents and two sisters to exhume the grave of her elder brother Christoph, who was declared dead under unusual circumstances at a hospital in Dresden, in the former East Germany, on June 22, 1975. He was 2 years old.
So my mum started really talking about, and it's only recently, in January 2018, she said, "I don't believe he's dead." And we're like, "Oh, okay." Because she kept it to herself all this time. And I said, "Well, then we need to do something about this." And now, I think now it's like really our chance to find out the truth.
43 years on, the family is hoping an exhumation and a DNA test will give them some answers.
I don't know what to expect. I mean, this is now 60 centimetres deep and they're going to dig another 30 centimetres and, well, we have to see what comes out. Yeah.
And how would you say you're feeling now?
A bit anxious, like what's in there, you know? It's going to be like, wow, what are we going to find?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, how are you? Come on in.
Yvonne's parents, Karen and Bernd, live in Freital, a town just outside Dresden. When I visit the day before the exhumation, a Sunday, Yvonne has just flown in from Australia, where she's lived for almost 15 years. Her younger sisters, identical twins Doreen and Kristen, have travelled from Sweden and Hamburg to be here. Inside the tidy home, there are photos of the three sisters on the walls. And standing on a shelf, there's a black and white portrait of Christoph, a cute little boy with curly blonde hair, staring into the camera.
There's always the picture sitting on the mantelpiece in the living room, and there was flowers next to it.
Yvonne, who's 42, was born 1 year after Christoph's death.
I don't know when I first knew of him. I feel like he was always there. But yeah, he's always present that we have a brother. Well, sometimes someone would say, yeah, when Christoph was little, then, you know, we did this or we did that. And they said, well, he passed away when he was a bit more than 2 years old, 2 and a half. And that's all we really spoke about.
So, hallo, mein Name ist Karin Ranisch.
The family lived under East Germany's communist dictatorship, a surveillance state where the Stasi, the secret police, went to extraordinary lengths to keep the population under control. Karin Ranisch, her long blonde hair tied back in a ponytail, says that was all they knew.
Das war nach dem Krieg, da war alles zerstört, vieles sehr kaputt. Wir waren ja mit dem System groß geworden. Auch
it was after the war. Everything was destroyed. A lot was damaged. We grew up with the system, with the whole idea that everything you were told, you believed. There was a lot you didn't believe, but you couldn't work against the system. Many did, but then you would have risked your existence, your children. So you tried to keep the family together and not to give the outward impression of rebelling.
Nach außen hin groß rebelliert.
They ran a tailoring business in Dresden. Before the Berlin Wall went up in 1961, Karin's sister fled to West Germany. It was a family connection they couldn't be too open about. Those who voiced critical opinions or failed to show loyalty could be persecuted, locked up, or have their children taken away. Yvonne believes their family was on the authorities' radar.
Yeah, so, the regime was everywhere. The presence, you had to conform. You know, it was a regime that tried to control their people, tried to infiltrate our families through spying and making sure that you were conforming to the system. We were not a very conforming family. My parents were running their own business, which was something that was not looked upon very well. So you did not work for the state, you worked for yourself.
But Karin says they kept a low profile and that their lives were, for the most part, normal.
We got married. 2 years later, Christoph was born. That was wonderful. It was lovely with him until suddenly he was scalded with this water, and our lives were turned upside down.
Das ganze Leben auf den Kopf gestellt hat.
It was a Sunday morning, June 22, 1975. The family was at their holiday house on the city's outskirts.
And my grandmother wanted to boil some water. And at the time, you just had a heating element, which you put into the water, and you know, was a cord which you attached to the wall to heat it. And he was playing, he was pulling on the cord, and the boiling water just tipped all over him.
It went on the front of his body and his thighs. I tore his clothes off straight away because I knew that fiber shouldn't get into the wound.
And
of course, you know, I was screaming, and my mom was just ripping his clothes off, putting him under the cold shower.
They had no phone, no car. Holding Christoph, Karin rushed outside onto the street to find someone to call the hospital. Soon afterwards, the ambulance arrived.
And I asked them, is it life-threatening? And they said, no, we've had cases that were far worse than this. And those children came through. And he was taken to the hospital, the medical academy. Today it's the Dresden University Clinic.
Da ist er eingeliefert worden.
Oh, they attended him, they put him into some sterilized dressings, and he said, well, he will be fine, it's not life-threatening. You couldn't stay at the time in a hospital with your child. They sent you home and come back tomorrow. And that was it.
Wir durften nur abends.
We were only allowed to call in at 8 o'clock in the evening to check how he was doing. And they said that under the circumstances, he was doing well. Then, early the next morning, we received a telegram telling us to come to the clinic straight away.
In die Klinik kommen.
And they said he passed away last night. No explanation.
Und der liegt aber nicht mehr hier.
And they said, he's not here. He's not in the clinic anymore. He's already in forensics. We didn't get to see him.
Wir haben ihn nicht gesehen. Auch am nächsten Tag.
The next day I asked again, I'd like to see Christoph. That's not possible, a gentleman told us. You're in such a state of shock that you're not capable of questioning them further. We were completely helpless, in complete shock.
Karin didn't know what else to do. She says there were two death certificates. One listed the cause of death as scalding. The second said pulmonary aspiration. Because of this discrepancy, because Christoph had only suffered burns from water and had been conscious and doing fine, according to hospital staff, and because they weren't allowed to see the body, Karen began to have doubts.
My mum, I think inside her, she had a suspicion, but you could never ever voice this. I mean, the doctors were the gods in white. You never question them. What everything they say is right. There was a lot of fear. If you didn't conform, something might have happened to you. And it's not the little person in there, like the nurse or the midwife or the doctor. It was a whole network of people. And everyone was scared to say something.
There was a funeral. Karen could bring some clothes for Christoph for the burial, a button-up shirt and some tights. But they weren't allowed to see him. The coffin was sealed shut.
At the time, in East Germany, you didn't have rights, especially with what happened to Christoph. We couldn't ask questions at the hospital or other authorities. But I've had this sense all my life that he's not dead. He's alive somewhere.
Der ist nicht tot, der lebt irgendwo.
After about 15 minutes of digging, the undertaker pulls out what looks like a femur and parts of a skull.
Keine Kinderknochen, nein.
But he says they're too big to belong to a child and that they most likely belong to whoever was buried here before. The Ranisch family huddles together in their winter jackets, peering into the grave. The air is heavy with suspense. Karin Ranisch has an album of photos with Christoph. Christmas time, his first birthday, when he started walking, the time she dressed him in a little Red Riding Hood costume for Carnival, when he turned two. A year after Christoph's accident, the Ranisches had Yvonne, and then the twins followed. Then, in the mid-80s, they decided to try and leave East Germany. They applied for an exit visa and got permission to move to the west, to Hamburg. Life went on. Karen's suspicions never went away, but she kept them to herself. Then the Berlin Wall came down. In 1990, East and West Germany were reunited as one democratic nation. Heartened by the transformation, Karen found a pretext to travel back to the former East to try and get hospital records, documents, anything that might tell her what had happened to Christoph. She met with a public medical officer, a contact from a family friend, but got no help there.
Und die hat mir das ausgeredet. Und die Amtsärzte haben ja.
And she talked me out of it. The public health officers actually worked for the state in GDR times. So she said, no, what are you trying to do? You won't find anything in the documents. And you have three daughters. Just let it go. And then I did really let it rest. But in hindsight, she simply persuaded me to do nothing.
Einfach überredet, das nicht zu tun.
And she went there and said, look, I really want to find out what happened. And they made her out that she was crazy. Why would you even think of that? Why would you even want to open all those old stories? Of course he's dead. What do you want to do? I mean, you're crazy. And so she left it. Because it also wasn't recognized that this actually happened. It was all, you know, swept under the carpet. And those people, not a lot of people were, had the guts to say anything because of that. Because people say, you're crazy. What are you talking about? Of course your baby is dead.
2 years ago, after retiring, the Ranisches moved back to Dresden. Meanwhile, other parents had started coming forward with distressing stories involving their missing children.
Now it is one of the last taboos of the former East Germany.
Recently, there's been a lot of media coverage shedding light on cases where kids were forcibly given up for adoption in the 70s and 80s, taken from people who were seen as unfit for political reasons and given to more regime-friendly couples. These reasons could be anything from leading an alternative lifestyle and liking different music to attempting to flee across the border. And there were also mothers speaking publicly about how they believed their babies, who were declared dead in East German hospitals, may still be alive somewhere. For Karin, it brought the trauma of Christoph's death back to the surface.
You have a mother's sense. I don't know. I've always thought it, but didn't tell anyone about it because they'd think I was crazy. But I'd always had the feeling that it cannot be. There were so many inconsistencies. Nobody had heard that these types of cases existed. It wasn't talked about. It was what the doctor says goes. There were no ifs or buts. That's why I've repressed it for all these years.
She finally decided to tell her family.
Yeah, it was a real shock. I was like, oh, I never thought of that possibility. And then, so I started doing some research, and then I found this interest group.
Die gestohlenen Kinder in der DDR.
Die gestohlenen Kinder der DDR. The Stolen Children of the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, or East Germany. It was founded in 2014 and now has about 1,750 members. About 600 of them are personally affected by missing children. Frank Schumann is the group's spokesman.
And for years, they've felt alone. Many had a suspicion that something was wrong, but they couldn't prove anything. And because there weren't a lot of people like them, they had the feeling that they were alone with their concerns, with their suspicions, and with their anguish.
When the Rheinisches first contacted the group, they were told to track down original documents.
Write to the hospital, write to the archives, try and get write to the birth, death and marriages office and try and get as much information as you can.
Karin has a folder of letters she sent to different authorities.
Universitätsklinik Karl Gustav Carus in Dresden. Sehr geehrte Damen und Herren, hiermit machen wir...
And the responses she's received.
Hier, sehr geehrte Familie Rheinisch, vielen Dank für Ihr obiges Schreiben. Leider muss ich Ihnen mitteilen, dass...
In each case, the reply was the same. There were no files left. Records in Germany only legally need to be kept for 30 years. So that's a hurdle for families trying to find information from the 60s, 70s and 80s. But Yvonne thinks there could be another reason for the bureaucratic dead ends.
It's not that long ago, so people who were in the system back then, they're still around. They could be just before retirement now, so they could still work there, and there's still a lot of cover-up.
In the group Stolen Children of East Germany, about 200 members are searching for children who were forcibly given up for adoption to families loyal to the regime. There are no reliable statistics for these kinds of adoptions, but most estimates suggest there were at least several hundred. It's an area of East German history that's still largely unexplored. Up to now, there haven't been any comprehensive studies into it. About 400 of the group's members are in a different situation. They fear the alleged deaths of their infants in East German clinics may have been faked and that their children were instead stolen by the dictatorship and perhaps also given away. Many of them are mothers who were told shortly after giving birth that their babies had died, but they were prevented from seeing the body. In some cases, they were barred from attending a funeral and don't even know where the grave is. Some reported that their babies were alive and crying, only to be taken away and never seen again. And then there are the inconsistencies in the paperwork. Cases where a baby boy is suddenly listed as a girl in the autopsy report, or where the birth weight and the death weight don't match up. It's important to point out here that there's no documented proof that hospital staff or state authorities abducted babies so that they could be given or sold to other couples. But where there's uncertainty and secrecy, there's also room for speculation. Schumann, the group's spokesman, says that if children were stolen, it could have been something that took place off the books.
Bei den vermuteten Kindeswegnahmen bei Säuglingstod, da gehen wir davon aus, dass es hier um Absprachen.
With suspected child snatching, with infant deaths, we assume that it would have been linked to collusion with something like child trafficking, organ trade, or even medicine trials. But it's very difficult to prove what the reasons could be. We believe that there was a system behind it, but one that's not documented, one that was configured by those who were in a position to exercise power and repression. They virtually set it out without written instructions and crafted a system themselves. And the existing structures fully exploited the opportunities and possibilities afforded by a state secret police, for example, or a state security service.
Eine staatliche Geheimpolizei beispielsweise oder ein staatlicher Sicherheitsdienst hatte voll ausgenutzt.
To find out whether there could have been some kind of state deception, the group has exhumed 5 graves over the past few months. One of them was carried out by Schumann and his wife Dolores, whose daughter Julia was said to have drowned in 1988 at the age of 3. Dolores was not able to see the body and has always had doubts about the death. They have found no record of Julia's death certificate and no autopsy report. They're still awaiting the outcome of further DNA testing. None of the exhumations have produced conclusive results so far. In one grave, no remains were found at all. In another, there were only animal bones. Schumann says it's important families are prepared to confront the possibilities of what they might find.
I can say from experience that it's important to think about the consequences of the results, how to deal with the outcome. Because if you've had doubts for 40 years and then suddenly there's a result on your doorstep, you have to be able to come to terms with that first.
Dann muss man auch damit erstmal klarkommen.
An exhumation may not guarantee answers, but the Ranisch family believes it's the only option they have left.
We want to have clarity. If he's in there and he died, we will never find out why. It could have been negligence in the hospital. Maybe that's what it was, and they tried to cover it up. We will never find out because we've written to the hospital, we've written to the archives, we wanted files. There's nothing there. They said it's all destroyed because you only need to keep the files for 30 years. If he's not in there and he is alive, that's then what do you do? They would have changed his birth date. They would have changed his name. So he's not Christoph Ranisch anymore. He's a whole different person. He's got a different identity. The only way he could be identified would be through scars from the scalding, from that accident on his chest and his arm. That would be the only way.
A little deeper down, there are splinters of what look like bones, but the undertaker says they're white fragments of wood, in German Holz. It's what's left of the coffin.
Auch Holz.
Holz.
Nee, Holz.
A piece of material surfaces, the sleeve of a small shirt. And then the undertaker pulls out some more material. Karin recognizes it straight away. The tights she gave for Christoph's burial 43 years ago. They're rotting at the seams and encasing what look like shin bones. Then they find other bones, which the undertaker confirms are likely part of a child's skull.
So what did he say?
Was war da drin? Diese hier?
He's missing bones, like where's the knee bone and like the femur.
Inside the huge brown building that was once the Stasi's headquarters in Berlin is the office of the UOKG, an umbrella group for victims of the communist dictatorship. Christian Sachser, who works as a historian here, says the fact that families still have unresolved trauma today is a huge problem. One he partly puts down to a practice at the time in East and also West Germany of whisking deceased children away and denying parents any further contact.
This way of dealing with death was very normal in the GDR. It was lax, cynical, secretive, and taboo. but they didn't take into account at all that the mother and father actually had a deep emotional attachment to their child, even if the death was 24 hours after the birth. This was very common in the GDR, and it was an extremely painful experience for people.
Zaxa doesn't rule out that babies could have been stolen from clinics, but he says it's unlikely. A medical doctor from the former East who spoke to him on condition of anonymity said neither he nor his colleagues were involved in faking infant deaths, but he did add that in some places he could imagine it being possible. Zaxa says it's an area that needs further study.
Sehr geehrter Herr Ausschussvorsitzender, sehr geehrte Mitglieder des Petitionsausschusses, meine Damen und Herren.
The publicity surrounding these cases has led to some developments. In April, the Stolen Children of East Germany campaign group presented a petition to the Bundestag, demanding more support for affected families. The parliamentary group of Chancellor Angela Merkel's CDU-CSU bloc recently said it wanted to prepare legislation to extend retention periods for archives at hospitals, adoption centres and birth and death registers to make sure no more records are lost. Among a series of measures, it also wants to create a DNA database where parents or children who suspect they've been adopted can submit their DNA for comparison. Schumann, the campaign group's spokesman, says it's a start.
Ob dann am Ende festgestellt werden kann,
time will tell if, in the end, we'll be able to say that there actually were human rights abuses, or if it was just carelessness on the part of authorities, filling in documents and records. We'll see then if we're able to clear everything up.
Das werden wir dann sehen, wenn wir alles aufklären können.
One of the undertakers says he doesn't think they'll find anything else. They're too deep. The shovels are starting to hit tree roots. To the side, on a white sheet, there's a small pile of bones collected from the grave, including parts of a skull and part of a jawbone with teeth.
It's a pretty scary thing. I mean, there was bones mixed with other bones, and we identified child bones, but there were not very many. So now we just have to wait and see what the outcome is. Yeah.
They'll send the remains to a forensic lab in Bonn, along with a DNA sample from Karen, for testing. After 40 years of wondering, a final result could be a few weeks away.
Ich habe immer nie eine Ruhe gehabt. Ich habe immer so gedacht, Mensch, der lebt noch oder so. Weil man ja nie.
I could never have peace, always thinking that he's alive, because we never had closure. If it's settled now with the DNA and he's in there, then it's okay. Then he had his peace and it's all fine. It was just so terrible how heartless the doctors dealt with us parents at the time. They had no sympathy, nothing. It was just brutal how they told us, your child is dead, you can't see him anymore.
Brutal wurde gesagt, ihr Kind ist tot und damit war's gut. Sehen können Sie es nicht mehr.
If the DNA test proves inconclusive or it's not a match, Karen says they won't let up.
Ja, dann geht die Suche weiter.
Then the search goes on. Whether we'll get a result out of it, I don't know. That will be very hard. We'll see how it goes. We definitely won't give in. We'll keep pursuing it.
Wir werden den weiter verfolgen.
Natalie Muller, DW, Dresden.
And that's it for today. The programme is produced with help from Helen Sini. The sound technician is Jürgen Kuhn, and I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on SoundCloud, Spotify and iTunes. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW in Bonn.